You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 79 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with the show on Twitter by following us at SMNP Podcast or pass by our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all, as ever, thank you so much for tuning in. Today, I have the pleasure of bringing you a conversation with one of the best and brightest political communication scholars, and that is Dr. Jennifer Strummer-Galley. She is a professor in the School of Information Studies and director for the Center for Computational and Data Science at Syracuse University. And in 2014, Dr. Strummer-Galley published the book Presidential Campaigning in the Internet Age with Oxford University Press. And the book looks at how American campaigns have adopted and innovated with digital communication technologies going back to 1996 and websites and going through to blogs and up until social media. And we're going to talk about that book in this episode, but we're also going to talk about the second edition that's coming out that includes a chapter on the 2016 U.S. election. And while the book is interesting in detailing how American campaigns have been adopting digital technologies, what's also interesting is there's always a focus on citizens and what it means for them and democracy, all these communication technologies coming out. And there's a couple of concepts that we dive into early in the episode I just wanted to set the pretext for, and that is the idea of interactivity and controlled interactivity, which you can read much more about in the book. But the top line is that interactivity is this sort of promise or the potential for feedback that a lot of these digital communication technologies have been built around. And that allows for citizens to give feedback to the campaign and for the campaign to give feedback to citizens and create this sort of feedback loop that, as Dr. Strummer-Galley notes in the book, doesn't actually seem to be happening. So the type of interactivity that citizens experience with the modern day campaign is one of a very controlled manner. So this idea of controlled interactivity is that campaigns strategically leverage these technologies in order to keep supporters on message, and in the case of the United States, extract money from them. So what you have then is this interesting dynamic between the technology, which is built around open discussion and creating interactions between different users, but when it comes to political campaigning, that interactivity isn't realized. And one of the most interesting findings from the book, I think, is that campaigns that tend to control their supporters the best are also the most successful. So there's no real incentive for new campaigns to open up the floodgates of interactivity or for down ballot races to try different models than what seems to work at the top. So the question then is, what does all of this mean for democracy? And in this conversation, we'll break it down. My guest is again, Dr. Jennifer Strummer-Galley, Professor of Information Studies at Syracuse University. Dr. Strummer-Galley, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
You're welcome, Michael.
So I have a host of questions about your research and ongoing projects. But first, I'd like to ask a bit about how you got into this field of research, because as your bio says, you were studying social media before social media was a thing.
Yes.
So what were you looking at kind of in those days? What got you interested into it? And then how did you get into presidential campaigning from there?
Oh, well, I've always studied presidential campaigning. I did my master's thesis back in 1996 on Bob Dole's website. And, you know, at that time as a master's student, I actually thought I would study social movements. I was really interested in women's rights and actually early women's rights in the United States. But then 2004, this thing, the World Wide Web and HTML was becoming a thing. And my husband's a software engineer. And I guess kind of along with him, I became really interested in this new medium for communication. And it was in, I guess, the late 2005 or early 2006 when candidate Bob Dole created this website to campaign on. And I don't know, I guess from that point forward, I've always had an interest in how it is that political campaigns are using digital media to try to organize their supporters and attack their opponents. And, you know, and I was raised in the political campaign research around television advertisements. So my coursework as a PhD student focused really heavily on political campaigns, TV advertisements. I followed in the footsteps of Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who was one of my mentors at the Annenberg School at Penn. And so it just, you know, in some ways that what's new is fun, new is sexy. And so that's basically where I focused. I actually thought I would do my dissertation on the 2000 presidential campaign. I really wanted to. That's a longer story for here. I didn't. I actually ended up doing interviews, like 69 interviews with people who talk politics online. But I watched the 2000 campaign very closely, and then 2004 and 2008. So I've continued to watch these political campaigns and how they use digital media. And actually, I really wanted to write a book back in 2000 about how political campaigns were changing the ways that they do the practice of campaigning because of the new affordances of the internet. But the World Wide Web was only 5 years old, 6 years old by that point. So it's hard to write a history of something that's doesn't have much history to it.
I think it's interesting that you started with Bob Dole's website.
Yeah.
You know, he was kind of before my time, but he was an old candidate from what I remember.
Oh, he was. Yeah, I think when he ran, he was 71. But he had a cutting edge website. Huh. And what I found so interesting, and it's one of, I know one of the questions that you want to get to, but you know, this feeling that in looking at his webpage, you could get a sense of who this guy was, which just by watching his TV ads or even watching his speeches, you didn't get the history, the depth of kind of who this guy was. But his website gave this new kind of insight on my own terms, right? I could go and see when I wanted to see and browse as much as I wanted to and then stop. Whereas TV ads, you had to be there actually watching to catch them or watching the speeches or those kinds of things, which, I mean, you know, who does that?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. So you've been documenting these presidential campaigns in your book, Presidential Campaigning in the Internet Age.
Yeah.
So eventually you got around to getting on the 2000 election and those things. And, you know, I want to ask some questions about the book, but I think the first one, and what I like most about the book is that, I mean, its focus is on candidate communication, but there's always this either implicit or explicit focus on citizens and sort of what that means for democracy. So I'm wondering if you can sort of explain to us why is it important when we're looking at campaigns to focus on the citizens and also what that means for democracy?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's one thing I wrestled with a lot in writing the first edition of the book, because a book can't do everything. What I wish it did more is look at the citizen piece, like the engagement by supporters, by the kind of the ordinary electorate and how they engage with these digital media. But it's, for me, you know, it came out of a rhetorical communication tradition, looking at elite discourse. Those methods are cheap. Surveying people is expensive. And so when you're poorly resourced, you focus on what's available to you. And so looking at political campaigns, but part of my interest, as you note, is thinking about how, again, I come out of a tradition that suggests that elite discourse sets the agenda. Politicians and political elite set the issues, the agenda. They set the tone, they establish and discuss our values. And of course, there's an interaction there. And so I don't want to make it sound like it's so top down, but especially in the mainstream media era. So basically up until the late 90s, when you had television and radio and print being the dominant forms of communication, that kind of hierarchical top-down communication, you know, the mainstream media was the mediator, but elites set the discourse. And so that's what set my frame early in doing this research. But my concern and curiosity is how it is that the digital media itself potentially restructures that dynamic. So, you know, in thinking about this concept of interactivity, what got me interested back in 1996, 1997 was that, you know, HTML and the way it was designed potentially enabled anybody to create a web page, right? It was a very low-cost medium. Mm. And you had to have a little know-how, but honestly, even back in 1996, 1997, it didn't take much know-how to create a web page. And so very quickly, there's the kind of, you know, this blossoming of a multiplicity of voices that wasn't just the mainstream media. But then looking at how the political campaigns chose the affordances that they would engage with around the architectures of the internet and what they would avoid or constrain, I found it to be a very interesting tension, right? So you have the ordinary public being able to now have greater visibility, greater voice in pushing an agenda in a context where before the elites basically set that agenda. But then, you know, political campaigns don't really want to fully engage all of the interactive affordances of the internet because it's costly, it's risky, they don't have the time. Their goal is to win. And so they need to use the technologies that will best help them meet that objective of winning. In an ideal democracy, right, it should be a public dialogue, right? Elections are a moment in time where the collective gets to reestablish our priorities. What are the most pressing policies that we need to address? What are our common goals and values? I mean, what you see right now in the United States, for example, is a very serious conversation about what is it that the United States values? Do Americans want the kind of discourse that Trump has established? Do we want something different? What does that look like? And, you know, all of that is interconnected with the communication technologies that we're using. So the idea of interactivity was just highlighting the fact that the affordances coming by virtue of the internet and the way it was designed in the first place enabled a much more free flow of voices to try to set that agenda. Mm. And, you know, but campaigns and political elites ultimately are still trying to control and set that agenda to meet their interests. So it's kind of a clash almost of the chaos and cacophony of the public and then this sort of effort at order and structure, but also towards a given end that ultimately helps elites.
Hmm. It's interesting. I'm thinking about when these candidates first started to have websites. I mean, I guess you're right in that there's this kind of blank slate of HTML code, right? Mm-hmm. That people can do anything with. And then how these candidates chose to structure their websites is only a small subset of what's possible.
Yes.
So I think it's interesting. I hadn't thought about that in terms of in the initial phase of, of websites. What do you pick? How does it function?
Exactly. Well, So in 1996, neither Clinton nor Dole had an email list. There was no way. If you went to the campaign website, the only way to contact them was to call them or send them a letter, right? And he couldn't give money. That's a whole other piece, which I find fascinating too.
We'll get to that.
I know. And so, by 2000, when Al Gore runs, his digital director saw that you could create discussion forums. So they actually had a couple of town hall forums. When John McCain was running the first time in 2000 on the Republican side, he set up a fundraising / town hall forum that was a live video stream, but then they took questions from the internet and had this kind of video plus text questions. To fundraise and also to sort of show that because there is an enactment of interactivity that campaigns do. There's a rhetoric of it around, I am the people powered campaign back to Howard Dean in 2004. And the idea that the internet helps the campaigns to enable their supporters to have greater voice in the campaign. Right. And so that there's this interesting rhetorical move that campaigns would do to say, we get the internet, we understand that it allows our supporters to have greater voice, and we're listening to you and we want your voices. At the same time that they're carefully structuring and sort of filtering how it is that the public engages with them through very careful design choices with their websites, with, eventually as you move forward in even in their social media, right? All of that is relatively speaking, carefully orchestrated. Mm.
So you have this with the arrival of the internet, you have all these potentials for citizens to interact with campaigns, this idea of interactivity, right? And so kind of dovetailing on what you just said, campaigns strategically work to kind of control that in a way. And so you have this idea of controlled interactivity.
Yes.
And I think what's interesting is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in the book, what you find is that the successful campaigns are the ones that are able to really exercise that control over the public with these new media. So can you unpack that, that idea of the controlled interactivity?
So part of what I was trying to get at with the concept is that there is a careful orchestration on the part of campaigns in their design choices to help their supporters organize effectively on the campaign's behalf so that ultimately the campaign wins. And because if it's just a free-for-all, and that's, the 2004 campaign was the election cycle where, especially in the primaries with Howard Dean and Wesley Clark, there was a kind of a groundswell. This is when we're using the jargon of netroots. Remember that? It's such a cute term. I look back and I go, oh, how sweet.
Which was basically like a discussion boards, right?
And discussion boards, blogs, just this kind of, again, organic bottom-up groundswell of interest and attention by the public that the campaigns wanted to kind of harness. But the problem for Howard Dean's campaign was, he was using a blog, it all of this conversation and energy and enthusiasm of his supporters, and it helped propel him from know-nothing candidate to front runner between January of 2003 to December of 2003. But then when the actual voting started, you know, he was finishing third and fourth in the key states. And, you know, there was the challenge for the campaign is they couldn't effectively organize their supporters to really work on behalf of the campaign. You know, I read every blog post, every comment over that entire political election cycle. And you had supporters doing things like, let's go to South Dakota and we'll paint the side of barns with, you know, Howard Dean for president. It's like, well, there are only, what, 40,000 South Dakota voters like who might vote for that candidate. So that is not a winning strategy, right? Mm-hmm. And the campaign knew this, but how do you pivot all those supporters and how do you surveil, watch, understand what they're excited by, what it is that they're engaging in, because they were organizing on third-party platforms like Meetup and MoveOn, which the Dean campaign, it took some time, but they didn't actually have much access to knowing who those supporters were and then trying to orchestrate them in ways that would be most beneficial to the campaign. So by the time we moved to 2008, part of the Obama campaign's secret strategy was in understanding that the best way to try to harness all that support would be to corral it, organize it on the campaign website itself, create your own social media platform where the supporters could come, register themselves, be visible to the campaign as supporter, and then create tools to allow them to fundraise, to make phone calls, to run house parties, to email their friends, do get out the vote effort, all with the campaign watching so they can see what it is that the supporters are doing. But again, all of that kind of carefully contained by the campaign. So it's no longer this kind of organic, multiplicitous communication channels, all kind of coordinated. That helped Obama to keep the supporters on message and working in a much greater accordance with the campaign's goals. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to Bernie Sanders in 2016, and you see something similar. So Sanders had some of the same energy and enthusiasm that the Obama campaign had in 2008, and relatively underfunded, et cetera, and also, again, try to help supporters to organize on behalf of the Sanders campaign. They used third-party platforms, again, like Slack, to help people organize, but they were really effective at keeping people on message. And that makes a difference. It helps.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the Bernie Sanders campaign, and something we've seen a lot with Trump since that election is when the campaign can't control what's going on. I'm thinking about these memes particularly. Right. So Bernie Sanders had a very active meme community on Facebook that the campaign kind of knew about and had this, you know, detached relationship with. But we also have, you know, just recently there's been with the Biden meme video, you know, being created by just a single guy who's, you know, gets retweeted every now and then by Trump.
Absolutely. I mean,
which seems to help Trump in this case quite a bit. And I think the Sanders meme stash did as well. So how do those sort of like new participatory meme forms of participation, I mean, how do they factor in?
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good question. I think other people are doing better research on this than I am. Going back, it's the challenge for campaigns, though, because ultimately they want to control as much as possible the communication environment. And so when a supporter or an opponent can create a viral video that crops up, then the campaign has to figure out how to deal with it. And it is, I think, in some ways harder for campaigns today to, you know, you can't quash that stuff. You just have to ride with it and figure out how to either make jokes about it or just ignore it completely and hope it dies out. But from a strategic point of view, it is the new reality for campaigning. So, you know, they control the interactivity as much as they can within their power, but then they also know that with these different communication channels, they're going to have to roll with the punches. And some are more effective at that than others.
And, you know, with all of these changes, I mean, memes being the last one, but also social media and blogs and, you know, all these things over time with so much potential, you sort of end the book on maybe a critical note that citizen involvement in the campaign continues to be a means to an end. And you go so far as to say that political campaigns, which are the core of democracy, are decidedly undemocratic affairs.
Yes.
So can you elaborate on that? I mean, we have the controlled interactivity on the one hand, but it seems that you're hinting that it's that the public is sort of being manipulated almost by these campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a... So I got beat up a little bit by one of the reviewers of the book for being overly normative in, and in fact, Andy Chadwick, who's the editor of the book series at a conference a couple years ago, was like, I think you over-egged that argument, which I thought was the most cute British phrase. So yeah, and so writing the second edition, I have thought more about my own assumptions around the democratic potential of these technologies. And, you know, did I actually over-egg the normative argument? I don't know. I'm still honestly a bit conflicted. I mean, on the one hand, part of what I love about the internet is that it destabilizes, it disrupts, it changes those power dynamics. On the other hand, I do feel somewhat strongly that that's what led to a Trump presidency, the destabilization, the kind of, I don't know, profound undermining of traditional institutions, I think has led to this opportunity that a candidate like Trump could come in and really capitalize on in effective ways. And so, I don't know, it's a very complicated dynamic, one in which I still worry that political campaigns and, you know, the candidates and their staff at times are trying to figure out how best to orchestrate, I won't go as far as to say manipulate, but we'll say orchestrate their supporters in ways that ultimately benefits them, which is getting elected. Mm-hmm. The game at the end of the day isn't about having a big public policy discussion, a you know, grand deliberation about the state of affairs. It's about winning. Mm. And so the strategies and tactics by campaigns ultimately are about that. And to the extent that they are manipulating voters to that end, I do think there is some of that.
And thinking about the role of campaign consultants, and especially digital campaign consultants, as as that becomes more of a need for campaigns to have as part of their organization. I mean, I'm thinking about campaigns and orchestrating or manipulating, because it's really not the candidate who's doing most of that, right? It's more the middleman, the people who are paid to convert, you know, people to votes.
True.
Basically. So I'm wondering if the greater role that they've had in campaigning maybe makes it more manipulative,
well,
because that's their job.
Yeah, but I would say that's not new, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been a concern through the modern era of campaigning. So during the TV era, once television became a thing, the concern was raised by good government academics and organizations that political advertising companies, the K Street executives, were basically selling candidates like soap. And you see from the 1930s through to today, this shift away from the party and the organization of the party. I mean, even in the 1950s and 60s, when the candidates were campaigning, they were still very strongly identified with their parties. And through the 1970s and 80s, you see more and more that the candidates distance themselves from their parties. And it's not about electing the leader of your party, it's about voting for this person. And so that individual-centered campaigning is a product, I think, of the shift to TV advertisements, the 30-second soundbite, the rise of cable news, and the 10-second soundbite. So any speeches are constructed, you know, when speechwriters are crafting speeches, the stump speeches, debates, they are paying attention to what will get you that little slug that gets repeated on the nightly news or picked up in the headlines. That hasn't changed. I don't even think it's really been exacerbated. I think actually in some ways the internet has challenged what the political campaign strategists have had to understand what to do. And so some of the schisms you've seen in political campaigning, especially in the mid-2000s, is the old guard of political strategists who are still in a television model, television frame of how to campaign, with the reality of digital media and the importance of it. And so there are, you know, very clear examples of strategists who don't get it, who don't get the internet, and so lose out on the affordances of the internet to effectively organize for the campaigns. But I think the kind of strategic sell the candidate, that's not new. Mm-hmm. That's not a new internet thing. That right. That goes back to TV.
So picking up on this idea of selling the candidate, so you mentioned in the book that the communication strategy is one part of the campaign. You also have things like image control,
yep.
The organization, but also money and
yeah.
fundraising, which is, you know, we've talked to some digital strategists on the show, and I think one thing that I kind of keep forgetting, but these strategists always remind me of, is just fundraising.
It's huge.
It's huge.
It's essential.
It's really one of the things that drives a lot of the innovation. So can you describe a bit how particularly the legal and the sort of financial regulations around the internet and getting money from the internet kind of affected how campaigns sort of turn to that as a sort of cash cow?
Yeah. Oh, it's huge. Huge. Yeah. No. So in 1996, campaign finance laws in the United States were such that, this is a longer, kind of more complicated story. So until 2008, from the 1970s until 2008, there was a public fund set up for presidential candidates to access. You know, the idea was to even the playing field so that wealthy multimillionaires and kind of ordinary people could all run for president, given the expense of running for president. And the largest chunk of the pie is TV advertisements. Still the case today, by the way. Mm-hmm. That's changing. That's fun, actually. But at the moment, that's still the case. So campaigns could, if they met certain thresholds, then could get this public funding to help support their campaigns.
And isn't it like $12 million?
There were caps. So, you know, it incremented up over the years, and there were some changes in campaign finance laws that increased the dollar amount. But it capped how much campaigns could raise and how much money they could spend. And part of the deal coming into, say, 1996 was that if a candidate wanted to qualify for that money, they had to raise a certain amount of money, but they had to actually get written checks. Remember those things, written checks? And so if a person wanted to give by credit card, that didn't actually qualify. So the candidate then couldn't say, I got, you know, several million dollars through these online contributions or through credit card contributions. It all had to be check. So going into the 2000 election, actually Bill Bradley, who was running on the Democratic ticket, basically appealed to the Federal Election Commission, which is our agency that oversees campaign and campaign laws and regulations. And so they ultimately ruled that credit card contributions would count. So 2000 is the first election cycle where you see campaigns really starting to figure out how to innovate. And John McCain is the first candidate who, a little bit by accident, a little bit by luck, and a little bit by strategic foresight, was able to really capitalize on a surprise primary win in New Hampshire to fundraise and demonstrated. They raised like $100,000 in 24 hours online. It wasn't like gigantic checks. You know, the typical way campaigns fundraise, or were fundraising, some still do, is through getting somebody to write a $1,000 or $2,000 check. But with McCain's experiment of getting small donor contributions in 2000 after his surprise win, this kind of phenomenal event that got a lot of attention to his campaign, his website put up a little splash page that, you know, said give $50. And so people gave. And that was the proving out that actually fundraising online, because before that, there was a lot of concern that people wouldn't want to give over their credit card information to a political campaign. They wouldn't feel comfortable with the security of their credit card going over the internet. So remember those days? That's all gone, right? Mm-hmm. You don't remember those days.
No.
I remember those days. And so those concerns about sharing your information online evaporated. And so as you shift forward to 2004 and then 2008, you see campaigns beginning to really experiment with how best to raise money. And Howard Dean's campaign proved out that you could get supporters to give repeatedly small donor contributions and kind of keep the energy of the campaign going. Then fast forward to 2008, one of Obama's big innovations was saving the credit card information so that you didn't have to keep entering your credit card every time or connecting it to your cell phone. And so those things all made it much easier for campaigns to fundraise, to get people giving $25 repeatedly, especially around events, so debates, if they were being attacked, right? So going back to a meme crops up that's negative to your campaign, fundraise on it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, get your supporters to be like, hell no, I don't want this to be out there. I'll give another $25 so that my candidate can respond properly and, you know, beat the other guy.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something I've been thinking about is looking at the European Parliament elections, because those are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
I've been seeing the signs around.
Yeah, they just started today.
Yeah,
In Denmark. And you know, these are huge events, huge democratic exercises. Every 5 years, so roughly equivalent to every 4 years that a U.S. presidential election is.
Right.
But the turnout is so low.
I know.
And there's a number of reasons for why that is. But I was thinking, you know, talking to some of these digital strategists, like, would there be any participatory increase by perhaps asking for donations or allowing small dollar donations to come into European politics? Because I think once people donate, they're invested.
Yep.
But those donations help to fund these really crafty organizing teams who in turn generate more money.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of curiosity around people in the EU, like, where is the digital campaigning in Europe?
Right.
Why aren't people innovating? Why aren't they, you know, like American campaigns?
Right.
And I think on the one hand, the money's not there.
Right.
Because they can't raise money. So I'm wondering how you think if maybe getting donations, you know,
that's such a good question.
Because bringing money into politics, you know, a lot of people in Europe look at US like that's crazy. And
yeah.
Of course it is. But I do think maybe, I'm thinking you know, rolling through this, put a cap on, you know, 25 euros per person, might that help drive some innovation like it has in the US?
Yeah, that is such a good question. And, you know, there is a buy-in, right? So if you, there is a vote with your feet kind of feeling. If I give $25, that's so much more than, it's much more meaningful in some ways than signing up to get an email update or just going to the website or following the candidate or the party on Facebook. There is something, I don't know, like, I really do care about this campaign and this candidate and this party, so I'm going to put some skin in the game. And that's the argument in the United States for why money should be allowed to flow in the ways it does in the US, that, you know, as a capitalist society, let consumers make their choices about where they want to put their money. And, you know, in the US, we use the dollar amounts that candidates raise as indicators of their likely success mm-hmm. on election day. So right now, sorry to go back to the US, you'll have to forgive me, totally, I'm an American, stupid Americans in our American-centric ways. So we have, oh, I don't know, depends on which day, 2022 potentially viable Democratic candidates all vying on the Democratic side to be the nominee going into the presidential election of 2020. And so you can't put 20 odd candidates on a debate stage. So the television stations are using public opinion polling and dollar amount raised as the two markers of likely viability. And so then those candidates who are demonstrating that viability, they get more press coverage. So Biden, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are getting a lot of free media now because they're raising tons of money. They're polling really well. Those two go hand in hand, by the way. And so the idea in the US anyway is that that helps weed out the wheat from the chaff because the organization has to be strong enough. The candidate message has to be strong enough. The candidate him or herself has to be compelling enough that people will say, yeah, I'll put some money in that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, right, there are lots of concerns about the corruption that that brings. There are still concerns that the wealthiest people ultimately buy the elections. Back in the 2016 election, 50 millionaires, basically, if you include Trump, decided the Republican viability of the candidates, because the way our fundraising system works is that wealthy people now can basically create their own political organizations and put tons of money into campaigns. So Ted Cruz, John Kasich, and a couple of the other front runners on the Republican side in 2016 never would have been viable. Actually, Ted Cruz probably would have been, but some of the others would not have been able to be as successful as they were, except that they had like one or two major millionaire donors that kept carrying their campaigns forward long after I think the public was like, eh. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the challenge, is that if you were to open up, and I do think it's a concern. I mean, the EU is a very important political institution in the European context, and the lack of enthusiasm, and it's been the concern since the very beginning of the construction of the European Union, it was the lack of ordinary Europeans' attention, passion. It's a very, you know, kind of bureaucratic liberal ideology, the organization, the if you just create the right institutions, then the best politics or political policies will prevail. But you do need the buy-in of the public. And if they're not paying any attention, what does that mean? But having said all of that, back to the United States for 1 second, we have local races and statewide races every year with less than 20% turnout rates. Right. So they still work, sort of. So I don't know. There is a bit of a crisis there when you don't have buy-in by the public. On the other hand, our campaign finance laws, which do allow, especially in a state like mine of New York, lots of money to be put into state and local campaigns, but you still don't get the kind of enthusiasm and visibility that you get on the national stage.
Yeah. And at least here in Denmark, you have the physical placards is still there. Oh, so that kind of brings things together. So what's coming up in the second edition of the book that you're working on now? Maybe a stressful question, but I mean so much. The book came out in 2014,
yep.
And then the 2016 election was just bananas, and it looks like you're heading into another one. So what are you writing about?
Yeah, well, so actually the second edition of Presidential Campaigning will come out in August. So I finally turned over the manuscript in October last year, only like 8 months late. It was so hard to write that. So book writing, I don't know, maybe some people, I'm in awe of their book writing prowess. The first edition was hard to write. When I saw how interesting the 2016 election was shaping up back in 2015, I went back to Oxford and I said, what do you guys think about an update? And they're like, yeah, sure. It's such an interesting election. There could be good reasons to add a 2016 chapter. But the election was so much more complicated and the turnout so surprising that it took me a sincerely long time to figure out what the story would be. It took a long time for me to remember the presidential campaigning, that book is not about the candidates, it's about the processes. But it was hard for me as an American citizen to move away from trying to understand why Trump won, like what has happened, what is going on in the United States. And it's not just the United States. I think there is a much larger kind of global trend right now around populism and a destabilization of institutions. And so Brexit, I think, is another very good example of this. But that shift is much bigger and much more complex. So it just took me a really long time to figure out the story. It wasn't until I did a little writing retreat with a friend in Italy in the spring of 2017. And that was when, is that true? No, sorry, spring of 2018. That's how long I sat on this stupid book. One chapter, took me forever, 2 years to write one chapter. But when Cambridge Analytica and the Facebook scandal broke, then it finally came clear to me how I could make sense of the 2016 election cycle with the theory that I had. Because, you know, the technology keeps changing. And so this goofy theory that I cooked up around control interactivity, it's still a thing, but there are other forces still also at work happening today. So I felt like I've already talked about control interactivity. So what's going on? And so how do I wrap that into a book that's about control interactivity? So that was very much a narrative challenge. And so in the end, part of the story of 2016 is about the shift. So going back to the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the television and hierarchies, the information environment in the sort of modern era of campaigning. And TV advertisements have always been what political campaigns, not always, well, basically since the dawn of television, has been the primary way that campaigns like to campaign. They control the message. They can try to construct their image in a way that is most advantageous to them or attack their opponents in this very controlled way. And as television marketing got more effective in terms of finding niche markets to advertise to, that felt to campaigns to be more effective, right? They could find those voters. So 2012, for example, one of the interesting things that Obama campaign did, so Obama had a problem in 2012, which was that he didn't have the enthusiasm that he had in 2008. So he had to try to energize his support base that wasn't particularly excited going into that election cycle. And they lost voters. They lost supporters. So they had to find new supporters. So
they just got basically clobbered in 2010.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. So they did some, he actually hired a network, a cable television executive to help do some modeling of data of the sort of Obama voter that maybe hadn't been so involved in prior elections, but could be mobilized to become an Obama voter. And then they did advertising on television stations that nobody had ever advertised to before. One is, we've got this kind of old TV station called TV Land. Mm-hmm. And so Obama ran lots of advertisements in TV Land because the people who watch that station are the kind of voter who met that profile. Hmm. Jump to 2016. Facebook. So Facebook reaches basically 80% of the public, and it has as much reach as cable. And with the additional advertising capabilities of Facebook, so there are things like lookalike ads. So a campaign can say, these are the sorts of features we want to advertise to. Here, we'll give you those features. We don't know who you're going to send our ad to, but we want you to send our ad to the Facebook walls as paid advertisements to people who match that profile. And Trump's campaign did it very effectively. Clinton's campaign did it as well. But Trump, I mean, his spending He outspent Clinton on Facebook ads like 4-1 during the general election season. And so the argument in the book is that you see a pivot to this idea of kind of mass targeted campaigning. So with the new affordances of targeted advertisements on Facebook, you see campaigns, they're still doing the free advertisement, they're still doing the free campaigns. So they still got the free accounts, their pages, their group accounts on social media, but they are going to very actively, and I expect this more so even in 2020, shift and spend a ton of money on paid advertisements to incredibly niche markets on Facebook. And Twitter and Google, but especially Facebook. Mm.
Yeah, and now they're even going to these over-the-top streaming services like Netflix and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, and then you've got things like Facebook Live, and I don't know if Periscope is still a thing. Is it still a thing?
It's eaten up by Twitter.
But it got eaten up by Twitter, yeah. But has Twitter done much with it?
It's just the live streaming service of Twitter. Yeah.
So, right. So, you know, these live streaming services, I think campaigns will keep using those too, because they do allow that sneak peek for supporters to feel close and connected. And so you can kind of see two. So campaigns are trying to do two things at once, and they always have been. Mobilize your supporters, get your supporters to be super advocates for you, and then find those persuadables, those people who are on the fence, who you can pull towards your campaign and get them to ultimately vote for you. Mm. And those two strategies, I think the digital media environment now allows both. Between 1996 and 2004 and 2016, between 2004 and 2012, campaigns really only could really do the organizing supporters, but I think more so now they can do the persuasion work on digital media that they used to do on television, now can extend it to the internet. So that's kind of the new story.
Yeah, and I have a couple last questions on these lines, which has to do, you know, looking ahead. So we have the Facebook ads is kind of well charted by now. There's campaign consultants are all over it.
Yep.
But I think Instagram, which was just coming out in 2016, but is now really, you know, something else. Yep. And has been shown to be politically viable with AOC and Beto O'Rourke and these guys. And going back to what you're talking about with live streaming, and I think it's becoming a staple. And you talk about in your book this idea of parasocial interaction.
Yeah.
And can you describe what that is? And maybe is this a new way for campaigns to achieve that?
Yeah, right. So parasocial interaction is a theory that comes out of television research from like the 1970s. No, that's not true. Hold on. It's Hurston Wall. It must be 1980s. They noticed that people who watch talk shows, so for example, Oprah Winfrey, people who watched Oprah Winfrey felt a connection to her. Like they knew her by virtue of just watching her on TV. And so they coined this term parasocial interaction, this perception that the public has, the kind of the viewership public has, that they really know the personalities on television, even though they've never really interacted with them. And so I felt parasocial interaction when I looked at Bob Dole's website back in 1996, looking at these photos of him and his war injuries as a World War II veteran, and just feeling this, like, I know this guy.
Right,
and
you're
this kind
that
of
at the
weird connection to him, like, and sympathy in ways. And, you know, Howard Dean's campaign used the blog very effectively to create this behind the scenes, you know, the hard slog that a lot of campaigners driving from location to location, eating junky donuts and hot dogs and, you know, not getting enough sleep and all of the stresses of the campaign, and kind of letting the supporters feel like they're part of it. They're inside because they get this insider knowledge, and that creating, like, I know this guy. That investment, I think, is really powerful. So then you go from blog and pictures to then short videos in 2004, 2008, and 12 to the live streaming services in 2012 and now 16 and forward. I think that the ability, as you mentioned, Beto O'Rourke, right? So seeing him skateboarding, or, you know, walking and talking and just kind of being himself gives you that sense that you're engaged, you're connected. And again, I think for organizing supporters, it is a really effective strategy to get that additional buy-in. That then gets more money, right? And greater enthusiasm. And then that turns into greater polling numbers. And you can take that money and energy, then put it into the paid advertisements.
Exactly. I have one last question. I might be opening up Pandora's box here.
Uh-oh.
But and I don't know if this qualifies as parasocial interaction, but you're doing a lot of work looking at communication flows on WhatsApp, and also the sort of the stopping of misinformation, which has kind of been really hot in the news with Brazil and limiting the amount of forwarding and all that stuff. So you've got that project with WhatsApp, and then you're also doing a project called Trace, which sort of gets to how, I don't know too much about it, but I'm very curious that it's sort of getting to the fundamental processes behind reasoning and debating online and stuff. Could you talk about that, those type of projects and what you're doing? Because the presidential campaigning is like one part.
Yeah, it's true. No, it's true. It's also why it's hard to write a book when you've got all these other projects going on. I have many, many things, all fun. So the WhatsApp grant is actually, and I have to give full credit, this is really Patricia Rossini's idea. Patricia has been working with me for like 3 years now. And she is a Brazilian scholar who's currently working with me as a postdoc and then heading off to Liverpool in a fellowship position. And she, WhatsApp had this call for studying misinformation in their platform. And WhatsApp's really challenging to study because it's end-to-end encrypted. And so it's not an easy platform to study because it's very private in that way. Although there's lots of groups and lots of group discussion that happens, but it's all kind of gated. And so it's unlike, say, Facebook, especially Twitter, where it's very open, you can kind of see what's going on. That's not the case with WhatsApp. And WhatsApp knows they've got a problem. They've had a number of pretty awful instances of people being killed based on rumors being spread through their platform. But because it's end-to-end encrypted, the employees at WhatsApp do not have access except for what gets flagged as being problematic. And so they put up this call. We wrote a proposal to survey Brazilians to understand. And the idea ultimately was to do this survey coming into the Brazilian election. Unfortunately, I think the social media platforms don't fully expect to get as many applications as they get. Mm-hmm. So they got something like 600 applications for the WhatsApp grants. And they funded 20 teams. And so so it took them a bit longer to make those decisions. So we are literally just this week going into the field in Brazil finally to do the survey. So part of it is measuring people's held beliefs and what portion of those might be potential misinformation. There's a lot of well-documented misinformation that was flowing through the Brazilian political information space. So asking some questions about exposure and perceptions. So we can just kind of better understand whether people perceive themselves to be exposed, whether there are differences in who's exposed and who's not, what people do with contentious discussions. So because especially the Brazilian election is very polarizing, like the U.S. election has been. And so we'll see what comes of that. So I have no results.
No.
But that's kind of in process.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
And we actually, we're very lucky. We have a little bit of money left over. So we're doing a U.S. survey as well.
Nice.
And we'll run that here probably in about 3 weeks. So we'll have a bit of a comparison in that. And then, so the Trace project, the origins of that are quite different. I've been interested for a long time in cognitive biases in decision-making and reasoning, and misinformation, disinformation. I'm doing research right now on conspiracy theories. And confirmation bias, which is a tendency to look for information that confirms your beliefs and to kind of ignore information that disconfirms your beliefs, is one of those biases that's at the heart of why it is that these kinds of misinformation streams, you know, take root and then spread. Because they kind of, like memes, right? They sort of capitalize on elements of our reasoning abilities and then can spread in ways that if we could slow down and really critically evaluate the information coming to us, we might never believe or share. But that's just not the reality of how our brains work. It's not the reality of our information environments. So the Trace Project, part of what I'm hoping to do, we're actually working on a pilot study right now, is looking for ways to help develop tools that would help people to critically think about the information that is coming to them and to see whether or not critical evaluation does actually help create resistance, if you will, to conspiracy beliefs. And so some of that is around crowdsourcing and kind of critical discussion and evaluation. So I've always had this belief, and I don't know if it's true, this is what I want to see, is when people are exposed to counter information or even just in a discussion context, if some, you know, I'm saying one thing and you come along, you're like, no, that's not true. To what extent does that potentially trigger me to reevaluate my own thoughts and maybe be a little bit more skeptical and critical of the information that comes to me in the future? And so part of what we want to do is some testing around that to see whether or not, even if I am kind of a core believer in some conspiracy belief, if I'm being challenged on that in some fashion, does that cause over time kind of reconsidering of those beliefs. Think of it as kind of like a mitigation. It's a prophylactic. It's a way to help potentially reduce the stickiness, the, the tantalizingness of some of this misinformation stuff that spreads. Mm-hmm.
And last follow-up question. Do you think that this relates, I'm thinking about how this relates to politics and the political environment where, you know, especially in the U.S., two-party system, extremely polarized, you sort of have extreme wings on both parties. I mean, do you think that plays into it? I mean, if you're going out and you're doing experiments or research in this environment,
right.
You know, you're at a great test case, I guess, for a super hardened political environment.
Yeah, it's so the part of it, I really believe in design. I've always been interested in, going back to presidential campaign in the internet age, in how these information technologies, the ways that they're structured, and of course this year of research speaks right to this. The way these platforms are structured shapes the nature of campaigns. It also shapes the nature of the interactions that happen among people. And so I don't think that we're not going to get these for-profit companies to change their practices. But I guess from a pure research perspective, I would like to know whether or not there are techniques that would make a difference. If there are techniques that make a difference that would help people to activate more critical thinking, to think differently, then how could you design something? What would that look like if you were to roll it out into a platform? That's a very challenging thing, though, because there's lots of, feel-good discussion spaces that die on the vine every day. So whether or not I can practically help, I don't know. But I would like to see whether or not efforts to get people to critically evaluate does help create a kind of inoculation, a resistance, a critical reflection that has some resiliency over time.
Yeah, it's a super important research. I think it gets to really the kind of fundamental, you know, human reasoning and cognition.
Yeah.
Important to understand the political environment.
Yeah.
But let's end on that note.
Okay,
and
sounds good.
Dr. Stromer-Galley, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Jennifer Stromer-Galley, Professor of Information Studies at Syracuse University. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Next time, you'll be getting another dose of academic knowledge with Dr. Ben O'Loughlin, Professor of International Relations at Royal Holloway University in London. But of course, you knew that if you were already signed up to the Social Media and Politics Podcast newsletter, which you can do at our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.